Welcome back to Kicking the Seat, a movie podcast from Alaska Anyone Asks. I'm, as always, that guy, Ian Simmons, and you're listening to the audio companion to kickseat.com. It's episode 608 of This Thing of Ours, and today I'm joined once again by Cole Rush of The Quill to Live for another edition of Late Screening. Each month we watch and discuss a movie Cole should have seen by now. Today's kind of a special one, as we conclude Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather trilogy with a look at The Godfather Part 3 from 1990. This is the first film series we've done beginning to end for the podcast. We cover a lot of ground here, so I won't belabor the point, except to say that if you have any insights as to alternate reality tech that might allow us to visit a world in which it's 1983 and Coppola hasn't yet put the capper on his masterful Godfather duo, you might want to smuggle this episode into the space-time chute, or however the hell it works. Lots of people have enjoyed bashing Godfather 3 over the years, but I'd like to think that Cole and I spent this podcast productively, exploring story choices that the director and co-writer Mario Puzo might have explored to make the operatic three-hour finale more than a footnote in any conversation about parts 1 and 2. Before we get to that, here's your final reminder to check out Kay Rubisek's documentary Finding Courage, which is now available to purchase online from the Swoop Films website. If you order by this Wednesday, November 25th, and use the offer code KICK at checkout, you'll get 25% off their amazing digital bundle. This harrowing story centers on a young journalist's quest to learn the truth about her sister, who was arrested and tortured to death by the Chinese government during a religious protest in the early 2000s. Rubisek follows Yerfei Wang, who escaped to America but whose family remains in China, as she describes the persecution of practitioners of Falun Gong, interviews former Chinese Communist Party officials about ongoing atrocities, and helps family members heal their wounds by sharing their stories. If you need more reason to check out the film, you can watch my interview with Kay Rubisek on the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel, link in the show notes, and once you're ready to take the plunge, head to swoopfilms.com/finding-courage-film and enter the code KICK at checkout to receive 25% off the Finding Courage digital bundle, which includes not only digital versions of the documentary, the soundtrack, a music video for the Mika Hale single Courage is Found, and the making of Finding Courage. You'll also get the 330-page ebook, Who Are China's Walking Dead?, featuring stories that didn't make it into the final film. Again, that's swoopfilms.com/finding-courage-film, promo code KICK. This is one of my favorite films of the year, as well as one of the best interviews I've done for the site, so definitely check it out. The offer is good through Wednesday, so don't delay. Okay, let's get this show on the road, or cannoli in the oven, or something. Please remember to follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at KickSeat. You can also like the Kicking the Seat Facebook fan page, subscribe to this very podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Amazon, and enjoy additional commentary, reviews, and filmmaker interviews on the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel, where right now you can watch the video version of my conversation with Cole. I'll be simulposting all of this week's episodes there, including our special Black Friday show, which you won't want to miss. Hint, Keeping It Real's David Fowley and I will be kicking off the Christmas season with a bang. And whether or not you like or don't like a particular video on the Kicking the Seat YouTube channel, please feel free to leave a comment with your thumbs up or thumbs down. I'm working to grow this channel and can only do that with your help. I also invite you to share this episode, leave a comment, and if you're so inclined, drop me a line at kickseat@gmail.com. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much for listening to the Kicking the Seat podcast, and take care.
We have no interest in anything illegitimate. The church owns the large corporation.
Worth $6 billion.
Don Corleone, this deal can make you one of the richest men in the world.
Friends, our business together is done.
Partners, they're unhappy. They think you abandoned them.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Mr. Corleone, we have a problem.
I said we make him dead. You give me the order, I'll take care of it.
It's not personal, Godfather. It's only business.
You're the only one left in this family with my father's strength.
Call your
yourself, Vincent Corleone. Our true enemy has not yet shown his face. When they come, they'll come at what you love.
All right, so I've got to set the table here. First of all, we are talking about The Godfather 3, but not The Godfather 3 that comes out in theaters, select theaters, next Friday, December 4th. That's a special edition reworking Francis Ford Coppola going back and trying to fix this thing with a new beginning, a new end. No, Cole and I, Cole Rush of The Quill to Live, joining me as always, we are here to talk about the old OG Godfather, the original gangsta Godfather, from 1990. And, you know, we didn't have access to the new version. And I don't think I even knew about the new version until after we decided to talk about this movie and watched it. So we're not going to watch Godfather 3 again.
The Snyder Cut, as we're calling it.
Yeah, the more like the Snyder Cut, because I don't have very many positive things to say about this film. I want to go on record as saying that the new Coppola version may redeem this film some way, but it'll be a while before I watch it because I got to get the stench of Godfather 3 off of my soul before I can revisit it again. And I want to qualify that by saying that I'm a huge fan, as is Cole, of Godfather Parts 1 and 2. So we're not just like Coppola haters here. The second caveat.
We're not a couple of haters.
Coppola. Oh, man, genius. This is
Coppola,
why
a Coppola haters. There's our title.
No, I already have the title worked out. It's Godfather is dead. But Coppola haters might be better. But I'll find a way to work that in. So the second caveat is that Cole and I actually had to redo this podcast because last week when we tried to talk about The Godfather, we had some severe technical issues. We only got about 10 minutes in, but this is our Coppola style restoration of trying to salvage something that didn't work the first time. So I hope you enjoy, and I hope you like this and subscribe to the channel and all that good stuff. And we're going to give you possibly a short conversation that will explain why you should subscribe to the channel. Unique content such as this. I don't know. Is it unique to hate on The Godfather 3? Do you hate The Godfather 3, Cole, or were you just annoyed by it?
I don't think this movie is worthy of my hate. Hate is something that you have to be invested in. So, you know, I hate very few things. But with the things that I hate with a passion. Like, it's a fun thing to hate them, you know? It's why people dislike Nickelback, because it's fun, you know? There's something about hatred that, like, you have to love the thing that you hate just the tiniest bit because you find some sick joy in hating it so much.
Wow. I feel like we could do a whole separate show just on hatred. This is fun. I like where this is going.
Yeah, but it's like I read this book this year, and I won't even say what it is because a lot of people love the book and consider it like a great fantasy novel. And I thought it was legitimately one of the worst books I've read in the past 5 years. And it's really fun to tell people how much I hate it. So it's like, am I mad that I read it? No. But am I mad about how bad it is? Heck yeah, I am.
This is an interesting question. And I think this will relate back to The Godfather 3 because I kind of had this running through my head while watching it. I don't hate the movie either. I didn't appreciate it the way that I appreciated Godfathers 1 and 2, which made it sort of even worse in my mind. But what I want to ask you about, this book that you were reading, were you aware of the praise and the stature it was being given before you read it? Or did this kind of come out after you had read it?
This book came out probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
And the author was given a multi-million dollar movie deal for the franchise, and the book was just marketing hyped. And I think part of the reason it did not live up to my expectations was because it got that deal and they forced the person to publish it too early.
Oh.
I think that's part of it. I hated the book regardless. And it received wide acclaim well before I read it. So like I said, I read it 3 years after it came out. The sequel's even out now and many people love that too. And I actually went in expecting to love it. I was really excited. And I find this thing of if there's a book I'm dreading reading, a lot of times I'll push it up on my to-read list so that I can get it over with. And if there's a book I really want to read, I'll put it like five books low in the list. So it's like a reward for reading these other five books. I'm kind of a reading masochist that way, I suppose. But that's what I did with this book. I waited. And then I read it and I was like, what the hell? This is nothing like I was promised. So to answer your question, I read it well after it received much critical acclaim.
Because, and that gets to my second question, which is, once you get into it and you realize that it's going south in your estimation and you're really starting to hate it, is the hatred augmented by the fact that you just can't get over how much it's been recommended to you and acclaimed? Does that fuel it? Does that shade your perception of the rest of the book? Or could it be that you're just reading a mediocre book that you think is much worse because of this perception of, oh, it was supposed to be great?
This is funny. I was talking with some of the Quill to Live guys about this exact thing earlier today. If I'm reading a book that I know to be well-loved by many readers, and I hate it, it just makes me hate it more. And it makes me mad that it received all that acclaim. It's something that's tough because there was another book I read this year that was a debut, and I read it right when it came out. And it's getting all sorts of praise. And I, you know, I'm incredibly happy for the author. If they're successful, that's great. But it makes me upset when I hate the book and everybody else seems to like it. And I'm like, am I the idiot here? Or is everybody else just wrong about this book? It's like, it definitely fuels the hatred more. But if a book is that terrible, even after it receives all this praise or is in the middle of receiving all this praise, it definitely fuels the fire. Like, I read books that I hate amidst the zeitgeist surrounding their release way faster than I read a book I love. And it's just a weird situation. But yeah, it definitely is fuel on the flames if I hate a book and it's receiving a lot of critical acclaim.
That, you know, I struggle with that in the realm of movies. And I think we've talked about this before. You know, the hype machine is very real in terms of, you know, cinema and also television. So it makes it honestly harder to get through. I mean, I imagine it's probably harder to get through a book because you read books lightning fast, but for me, it takes a while. So if I'm in the middle of something that's mediocre or terrible, the temptation is to just put it down. In terms of movies, it's a little bit easier, but with something like Godfather 3, Godfather's 1 and 2 are also long movies, but this thing clocks in at just around 3 hours. And I think with whatever Coppola's got cooked up, it's going to be even longer. So wading through mediocrity for that length of time, especially when it just feels like it's going nowhere, and you're just sitting there flashing back to the greatness of these, you know, once rich characters, it's depressing. And yeah, I can't build up the hatred either, but it just makes me sad. I think I don't know if that's the opposite of hatred, but it feels like it.
I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed. Like, that's how I feel about The Godfather Part 3. And it was weird. As I was watching it, I was just so distracted. And this movie is just so dull that it's so easy to get enraptured by something as simple as like a semi-funny tweet. And then you just go down that rabbit hole as you're watching it. And I also had the issue of, I had just received my new PS5 the day before I watched this. So that's on my brain. And already I'm going into Godfather 3 thinking, this is something I have to do before I can play more Spider-Man. And, you know, I was like, okay, I started it at like 11 a.m. and I paused to do laundry here and there. And I was texting friends and I was, you know, I was watching, but I paused it and just stopped it a lot. Or got removed, you know, for small stretches of time. And I don't feel like I lost anything from the movie for that having happened. It was just very meh. It felt like I don't know what like the dullest thing you can think of is, but like, I don't know. It's just blah. That's the way I can sum up my feelings about Godfather 3.
So did it take you like 9 hours to watch a 3-hour movie?
I do think it took me about 4.5 total.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I had to make lunch and I was just, there was never a moment where I was like, oh, I can't stop to go get the laundry now. I was like excited to get up and pause the movie for a second.
Now let's talk about what Godfather 3 is. It takes place in 1979, which I feel like it, because the movie in real life, I think Godfather 2 was, you know, was 73. 83. I don't have the date pulled up, but
yeah, we're now getting dangerously close to 80s territory.
Yes, we are, including with, you know, Vincent Mancini's leather dress jacket, which was pretty awesome. But it's also like, oh, they're just around the corner. But no, so this is like 20 to 25 years, I feel like, since the last time we saw the Corleone family, which is appropriate because it was like 20, 25 years since we've seen these actors in this part. And the main problem, I think, is there's a fascinating story set up, which is Michael Corleone, the head of the Corleone crime family in New York, has decided that he wants to go legitimate. And the only way he can really do that, or so he thinks, is by doing this giant multi-billion-dollar international business deal with this company called Immobiliare, which has ties to the Vatican. And he's got this charity where he's getting, you know, millions and hundreds of million dollars in donations. Even in trying to go straight, it feels like he's doing things that are crooked. But he keeps moaning about how he wants to go legitimate and legitimacy. And it's like a crazy Godfather 3 drinking game just with that word. That's an interesting idea. But the problem is, the last time we saw Michael Corleone, he was fully, you know, over in the dark side. He had his qualms in Godfather 1 because he was just a military guy who got reluctantly drawn into the family business because everyone around him was dying or becoming incapacitated. In Godfather 2, like, by the time he has Fredo killed, like, that's his Anakin Skywalker taking the hand of the Emperor moment. There's no coming back. But then we flash forward, the next time we see him, he's trying to go legit. And I feel like Coppola and Mario Puzo, who wrote the screenplay together, toy with the idea of, is he really interested in legitimacy, or is legitimacy a front for him trying to do these shady business deals? But Al Pacino is just so, like, mopey and snappy and snippy throughout this entire thing that I just didn't care, and I couldn't get a beat on what his character was about, and everything kind of cascades from there and just becomes, you know, bland.
It's just, it's very boring seeing Michael's development. And there's this aspect of Godfather 3 that I think was already covered in Godfather 1, which is Michael's reluctance to be part of this machine, this mafia machine that just brings so much death and destruction on people. That's kind of his whole storyline in Godfather 1, is I'm going to try to go to college, do my thing. And then at the end, he's like, oh, it's me, I'm the Godfather now. Like, that's the end of that storyline to me. That's all the narrative I need to show his reluctance. Now I just need to see a Godfather doing his thing. Okay, sweet. That's part two. And in part three, it's a two and a half plus hour exploration of a story that neither needs nor deserves to be told, in my opinion. And the aspects of this movie that could have been good, I think were already done better in the first two. And there's just not a lot there to redeem Godfather part three. And it's another thing to consider is, one and two, I was convinced by all these characters. I bought Sonny as the hothead son who really wants to protect his siblings. I bought Vito Corleone as this terrifying mastermind. And part two only, you know, enhanced that reading of him because it shows his whole backstory and how he came to power. Part three, it's all just a bunch of boring people doing nothing and singing opera. And I'm like, this is not a Godfather movie. It doesn't even feel like a Godfather movie. It feels like really back script for Games Without the Dragons.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned Game of Thrones, because I think there really could have been something. I think we talked about this on our Scuttled episode, which is, it would have been cool to see this as Godfather 4 if there had been a Godfather 3, like, in the mid 80s, to show this transitional period. Because one of the other aspects of Corleone going legitimate is he's handed off the street level crime dealings to this low level gangster named Joey Zaza, played by Joe Mantegna. And he's got a contentious relationship with Sonny's bastard son, who's Vincent Mancini, played by Andy Garcia, the guy with the leather, you know, dress coat that we mentioned. They've got beef, and Mancini is convinced that Joey Zaza is making a play to, you know, kind of take over or usurp Corleone's good name with the five families, or this kind of consort of, you know, the people behind the scenes, the really wealthy folks from all over the country, who we do see at this Atlantic City conference, which ends up getting kind of blown up and shot out by a helicopter, which is kind of a cool scene. But I just I could see an entire movie about Michael Corleone trying to get out of that street life and getting pulled back in, or the manipulations he would, who does he have to buy off? Who does he have to kill in order to become legitimate? Because as we see in this film, there are interests at play that very much they're invested in him staying crooked. And I think that Vegas or that Atlantic City scene is emblematic. He passes out like these $50 million checks to people. But even then you get the feeling of like, if I'm getting $50 million now and this is it, how much more could I have made if, you know, we kept our puppet strings like the Godfather logo implies? But this is just, we're missing a whole lot of character in this movie. On top of that, there's this weird subplot where Michael and Kay are maybe going to get back together. He does this wacky thing like they're in Sicily and she wants to go for a ride in the countryside, and he is the chauffeur and he turns around, whips off the chauffeur cap and has this big Daffy Duck smile like, hey, we're going to get romantic. I'm like, this is some, you know, Nora Ephron bullshit. This is not The Godfather. What's happening here?
Yeah, I remember watching the scene in 3 where he it was like 2 seconds. He very quickly remembers what happened to the girl he fell in love with in Sicily. And I think it was part 1 that all happened.
No, 2.
It was when he went to Italy and had to hide away.
Yeah.
And that to me is part of the most interesting aspect of Michael's story, because he falls in love with this woman while he's in hiding from the terrible thing he did for his father.
You know, it might have been
definitely
one.
Yeah. I was like, Ian's the movie guy, but I think I'm right on this one.
No, when you were describing, I'm like, yeah. So I apologize. The one time I've ever been wrong in this whole podcast.
All is forgiven.
Thank you.
The cold giveth and the cold taketh away. I really love that storyline because it shows the two sides of Michael's world. And it really emphasizes that juxtaposition of like, the legitimate relationship with Kay, the legitimate relationship with the illegitimate families, like, you know, who I don't even remember her name, but I love the character. And I almost wanted that. Like, if you're going to go legit, I would think that Michael's only course of action is to like hole up somewhere in Sicily and just like Instacart all of his groceries or something. And I think that I would have liked a more deep exploration of his character and the fallout of Fredo, the fallout of all the people who were killed, and the fallout of that girl's death. Been a more worthy exploration of the character than I'm trying to go legitimate. Here's the most convoluted storyline in the history of everything coming from the Vatican, which already has the Bible, one of the most convoluted storylines of anything ever. So it's like, what? I just don't get the purpose here. This movie doesn't do anything for me. And it's funny, the further removed from it I get, the less I care about anything that happened in The Godfather 3.
And I think one of the bits of frustration, I don't know if you picked up on it, but it was something that annoyed me, is that structurally, this movie is trying to do everything The Godfather 1 and 2 did. Now, Godfather 1 and 2 have certain structural elements that make them of a piece. You know, the climactic multiple murders happening at the same time, you know, the hits that the Corleone family ordered while they're like getting their son baptized or doing something else. They bring that back, much like in Godfather 1, instead of a wedding, it's this charity ceremony in Michael's honor, you know, a big dance and an extended scene. It's just, they're so similar and yet so kind of thematically dead and uninteresting, like these murders at the opera house, kind of who cares, because it's just a bunch of random hitmen that we haven't really been invested in. Oh, look, they're twins. That makes it interesting. No. but it's just so all over the place that as they keep peppering in these kind of callbacks to the first two movies, I just kept thinking, I want to go back and watch the first two movies.
You know what I want? I want a movie where it's revealed in the first scene that Fredo faked his death knowing that Michael was going to order his assassination, and then rises to power elsewhere and plans the assassination of Michael. That's a movie I would watch.
You know what? There's a line. I think it's when, yeah, it's after the Atlantic City hit, when all of the heads of the families are, you know, killed except for Michael, because Vincent, you know, puts him on his back and like horse rides him out into safety, which is, again, it's a cool scene. But later in the kitchen, that famous scene, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. He says, our true enemy has not yet revealed himself. Now, they're talking about the folks in Sicily. There's this Lucchese guy who is sort of masterminding the whole Vatican deal involving like the old pope and the new pope and that kind of political bullshit intrigue. But that would have been perfect for what you're talking about. What if there was this it's a very like comic book movie kind of a trope, yep. But what if there's an unseen mastermind that's going to step out of the shadows at the end, especially if it's Fredo, because he was such a lame character. But mm-hmm. What if, not if he had faked his own death, but what if he had just somehow survived? Like, I think they mentioned that they buried him in a shallow grave or something, but what if the deal, he'd been shotgunned and he just fell over into the lake and the hitman was like, good enough for me, and he rose back, but then Fredo crawls to shore and then vows revenge. It's a completely ridiculous idea, but it's got more intrigue and would say more about these people's relationship during the entire 40 or 50 years of this story than what we get in this movie. It's supposed to wrap it all up.
Yeah, so movie companies, take notice. I am for hire, and that idea is not free. It's going to cost you.
I have to put this episode up behind a paywall now. Thanks.
However silly that plot may be, and it also may showcase the types of things that I normally gravitate towards, it's basically the plot of Wicked, now that I think about it. But wait, Godfather plus Wicked musical?
Wicked smart.
The money makes itself for us, Ian. I just think that there's so much more character work to be done here. And whether or not you bring Fredo back from the dead, you have a duty to the viewers, I think. And you failed it in Godfather Part 3. And I think before our episode got cut short by my internet wonkiness, the last thing I heard you say is something that I want to discuss. And it was these words. It's kind of a trope that Sofia Coppola sucks. And that was the last word I heard, but it was all that I really needed, because what the hell is going on with Mary? There's something about her.
Yes, long before we knew something about Mary from Jizz in the Hair, we had Sofia Coppola, who is, and I should set the record straight here, as I did on that failed conversation. You know, I respect the hell out of Sofia Coppola as a filmmaker. You know, she's actually got a movie out right now with Bill Murray and Rashida Jones that I haven't had a chance to watch yet, but you know, it's got a lot of buzz and I'm hoping to check it out for award season. But you know, she did a movie called The Virgin Suicides, which just completely knocked me out, and a number of other films that she's got that great indie spirit, and she has a lot of insight into the human condition and loneliness. But I don't know if she even did much acting after The Godfather 3. She was 18 or 19 when she made this movie. She's the director's daughter. She was a replacement for Winona Ryder, who I don't know if she would have been even any better, but she would have been an interesting, you know, I'd like to visit that alternate universe. She has a great look. She looks like a mobster's daughter. She's got these great, like, lush pillow lips and kind of a sass to her attitude. But the moment she opens her mouth, she's just got this...
It's monotone.
It's monotone, but it's also bratty isn't the right word, but there's just something. Yeah. I think it is. The key is probably the monotone.
I think what it is for me is I don't get a character from her. I get Sofia Coppola playing a character. I don't believe Mary at all. And I think it's because I don't know what it's like to make a movie when you're not the director's daughter, but I can imagine that it comes with perks when you are, like, and that you probably get a few free passes, but when it makes your movie worse, like, did you really make the right decision here? That's my question.
Yeah. And you know what it is? I think I had thought about this before. It's a table read kind of an affect. It's mm-hmm. almost like Winona Ryder couldn't make it to the table read today. So here's my daughter, Sofia. She loves the movies. You know, she's grown up around all these people, so they're kind of like family. Sofia, you read the Mary part. And then, oh, what, Winona dropped out? Sofia, you step in front of the camera, sit down with Al. We're going to measure the light and the costuming and everything. Oh, well, hell, you're just in the movie now. Because when I see her sharing scenes with, Diane Keaton, with Al Pacino, I'm like, and this is no offense to her, again, because she was a kid when she made this movie, but she was so out of her depth that I'm surprised that Coppola, who is a masterful filmmaker, couldn't see past that. I don't know if he thought that it was a time thing, like he felt he was out of options or what, but she really does sink the movie. The character isn't that well drawn, but when you, it's an opportunity for a performance to really elevate the material. But when it's a performance this bad, it does the polar opposite and just calls into question. It's ooky enough when you've got two first yep. cousins screwing off camera, albeit, but a romance. And I'm supposed to be invested, like, no, I really want them to get together. I don't want them to get together. And these actors are not selling.
Yeah, I want convincing. Her to go off and do music like her brother. I don't need her to do any of this. And there's the scene where she goes, I love him, talking, I believe, to her father about Vincent Mancini. And I'm like, you made out once in a kitchen while you were making gnocchi. I mean, that could be love. If Aaron and I did that, I'd be very happy. But it's not like you don't do that once and then just fall in love. You have to, if that's going to be your moment where like they talk once at the party and then they talk once and kiss in the kitchen, like you got to do some heavy lifting acting wise to convince me that's love on screen, which is even funnier because they get so little screen time compared to the rest of the movie together. Like you have to do so much work to convince a viewer that that's real, and none of that work is done. And I don't even think who Mantegna, who plays Vincent Mancini, is that him?
That's Andy Garcia.
Andy Garcia. I mean, he didn't do much for me either. I kind of liked him as just like I'm the guy. Like, let me in. He's kind of a joke the whole movie. And I'm like, fine. But then when you bring this whole Mary storyline in, I'm like, none of this jives.
Yeah. And, you know, even Mancini would have been an interesting character because he's Sonny's kid. So he's got to be the hothead, which it almost feels like lazy writing because it's like my dad was a hothead, but I was born before, you know, he died
after
before
he died.
I was,
right. Yeah.
Right. So it's not like he saw this behavior modeled necessarily. I don't know how
he's like,
up.
I've never paid a toll in my life.
That would have been funny, like if he had an irrational fear of toll booths for some reason.
He just plows through the thing that comes down and fuck you, toll booth. I'm Vincent Mancini.
Someone needs to do a Not Another Teen Movie style parody of The Godfather.
Where the toll booth just chases Vincent Mancini through. It's like Game 4 meets The Godfather 3.
Yes.
Yes. I would watch for Godfather 3.
But yeah, so it's a weird character because he's like this hothead who's kind of muscle, but he's got such a temper and he makes an occasional good call, but I still don't feel that's enough for for Michael Corleone to hand this, you know, this responsibility over to him. I feel like there would have been more likely a conversation where he's like, you're a great kid, you got a lot of heart, you've got a temper, and I understand and respect that, but I can't let you run my business because you're going to destroy that, and eventually that's going to get back to me. Then maybe have Vincent Mancini actually turn against Michael Corleone and have that kind of palace intrigue, have him sign up with the Lucchese's for real instead of this weird double agent stuff, because that's not an effective device either, because when he's playing this double agent, you're just waiting for that storyline to play out because you know that he's just playing the enemy against Michael. So it's like, and it doesn't amount to anything. It's like, okay, I'm with them now. Now I'm with you. Now I'm with them. Like, who cares?
Yeah. It's a lot of back and forth. I kind of get the impression that to Michael, in this movie, he's kind of like a 50-year-old or like a 55-year-old who marries and has this stepkid who's like 16 and keeps fucking up. But the 55-year-old's just kind of like, I'm done parenting. Just like, fuck up. Go do what you need to do. You know, that kind of vibe. And both Vincent Mancini and the larger crime organization are those stepkids that Michael's like, I'm done. Like, I just want to watch The Price is Right in the morning in my slippies. Like, I don't need any of this. And I'm not speaking from experience there. But yes. As I wear my slippers. Yeah, right. But that's the impression. And for the Mancini character to work, I think he has to have a good foil in Michael, because we've seen Michael be devious. We've seen him be conniving. We've seen him be cut. And for Mancini to be meaningful in any way in this movie, you have to have that Michael, not this dejected guy who's just content to let anybody do whatever. Like, oh yeah, bring a helicopter, shoot up my business meeting. It's no big deal. everybody will die, but I'll get out. Like, it's Michael's just a plot device at this point. It's really disappointing to the character.
Well, and that's where I think this interim movie between parts two and parts three would have come in handy, because in our aborted conversation, I mentioned that the jarring difference between Michael Corleone at the end of two and what we see at the beginning of three reminded me of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, where at the end of the Dark Knight, Batman has taken on this mantle of the on the run vigilante in order to protect the people that he loves and the good name of his best friend. So he goes off into the night and he's like, they're going to hunt. Gordon's like, they're going to hunt him because they have to. And he's the symbol that we need, but not the one we deserve right now. And then you're like, okay, cool. So he's going to have these covert adventures. I can't wait to see part three. Part three opens up like 10 years later or something. And Bruce Wayne's, it turns out that that was his last night of being Batman. And they just hold up as a hermit in his house. I'm like, no, what? I need some context here. This has to work, but it just really doesn't. If we had seen Michael Corleone, something really terrible happened to him in part three, where he's pushed out or pushed to the side, even by his own volition, he gets depressed, kind of like what he is in this movie. But then we have the comeback film where he realizes, no, the family needs me. Everything's falling apart. I have to go back and become that thing, that monster that I was, for the good of everybody. Then that would have been something great. Even at the end of this movie, when the dirty work needs to be done, he just says, okay, Vincent, now you're the Godfather. Go do this other stuff. So it's Vincent calling these shots. And then there's other hitmen carrying out things. Michael is so far removed. His hands are technically dirty, but they're not really. He's just sitting there smiling at his kid in the opera box.
That's exactly right. And soon Bane's going to come on the loudspeaker and be like, this opera sucks.
There is a climax involving steps that would have been great.
There you go. Well, there's this scene in The Dark Knight Rises where Bruce Wayne, his back heals after being completely shattered by just hanging from a rope for a few days. So like, maybe they could try that with Fredo to heal the hole in his head. I love the Dark Knight Rises parallel because, well, number one, I don't know if you had this experience, but after Dark Knight came out, a lot of my friends at the time were like, Dark Knight Rises is the best movie I've ever seen once that one released. And I remember for a period of like 2 to 3 months, I was like afraid to tell anybody that I liked Dark Knight better because everybody was still riding the hype wave of Dark Knight Rises. This is completely unrelated. I have no tie to The Godfather. I'm just pissed about it.
All right.
The Dark Knight is objectively a better film than The Dark Knight Rises. It's just like when people say Skyfall is better than Casino Royale and it pisses me off. So if anybody approaches me and tries to tell me that The Godfather 3 is better than 2 or 1, we're going to have some words.
I don't think this might be a legit statement. I don't think there's anybody out there who thinks that. I mean, I look at IMDb and that's not necessarily the go-to for anything, but it does have a 7.6 out of 10 rating, which surprises the hell out of me. I don't know what Godfather 1 and 2 have, probably like an 11 out of 10. But there are people who defend it, but I don't think there's anyone who's going to say, yeah, this was a worthy successor to those films or better than those films. It's The Godfather. So by a transitory associative effect, it's got to be at least really good. But I don't
think so. Well, it's like if you look at these other trilogies we're talking about, like, worthy successor is a great barometer for like how these sagas, I guess, conclude. Like, I think Dark Knight Rises was a worthy successor. It had its fair share of problems and like they're pretty obvious, but you can accept that movie at face value as like, this was a fun viewing experience. It had some worthwhile ideas. I'm in, but like, there's no way it was better than Dark Knight. Godfather 3 has literally none of that for me. It's like a complete, if you're on this plateau of greatness with 1 and 2, you just dive off the edge into the abyss for 3. And that, I think, is what is most disappointing. Like, it would have been such a different conversation if they had just tweaked Michael's character a bit or tightened up the story to be more family related. They try to give you the full sampler platter here. Like all the appetizers, you get mozzarella sticks, jalapeno poppers, chicken wings, quesadilla, and then you eat it all and you're not even hungry for the full entree. It's very disappointing. It's very, I don't know like what the word is. It's a buzzkill to me.
Yeah, and this is something else we sort of talked about earlier in terms of the story possibilities, because early on, Anthony Corleone, who's Michael's son, the one who becomes an opera singer, he was in law school. And there's a scene at this, you know, it's sort of the Godfather in the chambers scene that we saw in the first film. But during this charity event, Kay brings Anthony to Michael and says, you know, he doesn't want to, he wants to drop out of law school and become a singer. And when I'm glad they clarified it with opera, because when I first saw him, like, what is he going to like be a disco artist? What is this? But Michael is like, no, absolutely not. But then by the end of that scene, he's like, yeah, fine. He can go be a singer. There's no fight to it. And I think a missed opportunity. There's actually two. One, if Michael had had an interest in his son becoming a lawyer, because that would have given him a way into like the DA's office or just like the law field to better protect his interests as a crooked, you know, crime family, or to help his business go legit. Either way would have been interesting. But the second,
or aspect, launder money via right. a record label that puts out all of his son's music. And little known fact, Anthony Corleone is actually the first half of popular rock group AC/DC.
I didn't know that. Okay. Okay. Wise guy. Who's the DC?
Da Corleone.
Or Don Corleone. It's there the father's go. Son.
Anthony Corleone, Don Corleone. Michael is left out of the picture.
There you go. It's a real Darth Vader, Kylo Ren situation. But the other possibility would have been, if you want to have like a family dynamic of jealousy and intrigue, you've got Anthony Corleone, who's the son. Now, granted, he doesn't want anything to do with his dad, but that's just kind of established in this movie. What if there was this bastard stepson, kind of a Mancini character, who comes in once again to the organization, and he has to vie for Michael's attention as the son he never had with the son that he actually did have, which is Anthony, and have that kind of a rivalry going, a fight for the family, almost like you saw in the first Godfather movie, where you've got the three main sons. They're not fighting each other, but they're fighting these external forces, but it's still sort of a power struggle for affection and also position within the business. If you wanted to have this movie relate have so many callbacks, I would think you'd at least narratively want to have something structurally. So even if we're kind of watching the same thing, we're watching it with different characters and a new patriarch that is different from the one we saw in the first film. So he's going to bring Michael's experience to this rather than Don Vito's.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, again, unsolicited screenplay advice for Francis Ford Coppola. No,
sometimes you out with the point and I just agree with it, and there's nothing more I can really add to the picture there.
Well, yeah, I'm done monologuing. But yeah,
this is a beautiful soliloquy.
Well, thank you. And that's
soliloquy and Simmons.
Okay, this is your last appearance on this show. So thank you.
I'm surprised it took this long.
But no, so here's my question, because I kind of told you where I was at the beginning of this. Are you interested in seeing a new version of Godfather 3 with a new beginning, a new end? The article I read didn't say anything about meddling around in the middle, but there was going to be like a new opening, a new coda. What's your take on that?
Hard pass. I don't need that in my life. I think that this movie is so low in my perception that like it's still going to be a glass half empty type of deal, even if it improves minimally. I just don't see much redemption here. And it's also like, if you could have made that movie to begin with, why didn't you? And I get that there are always production issues, you know, things happen when you're making a movie, it's business, but I just said this was so meh to me. And I'm looking at my IMDb now and it says The Godfather Coda, which is an interesting, I guess that fits with Anthony's singing career. But I don't even know what to say. I have no interest in this. I had no interest in watching the 2 hours and 50 minutes of it at first, you know, beyond I want to see what's next, but everybody told me to temper my expectations, you especially, and that proved correct. So this is just another, like, I don't need to see, I already saw a turd. I don't need to see a polished one. It's going to be a shinier turd.
So maybe we'll talk about it on the 40th anniversary of Godfather 3. We'll go back and watch the Coda version. No, that's something else. Because when I saw your enthusiasm in the Facebook message, like, I'm going to watch it tonight. It's like, did you say something like, I hope it's great or something? Like, yeah, it's some kind of a pun.
I'm very popeful.
Yes, you're very popeful. Great pun, by the way. And then I said, you know, temper expectations like ... a lot. I wonder, did I plant a seed? Is that something, were you going into be like, oh God, no.
I don't know. It's weird. Like when I can't always really tell, like when you really love a movie, because you're very good at keeping pretty neutral. Like, especially when we watched Better Off Dead, you know, you didn't want to come in saying, I love it, so that I didn't come in to say, oh, I hated it, you know, or I guess what I'm trying to say is your perception of a movie, I guess, could possibly tint how I watch it. But I think we talked about this very briefly in the episode that got lost, but in the lost archives of Kicking the Seat. I just like, I think I'm pretty good at going into a movie just saying, I'm expecting to enjoy this. And that's kind of the baseline. And then my barometer, my line moves from there. It's kind of a wavy thing. In the case of The Godfather 3, it kind of went like this and just tanked. But in some movies, it goes up and down and I kind of settle on neutral. But what I've learned over the past few years is it's hard for me to really dislike a movie. Like, a movie has to do a lot to be bad enough for me to think like this was not fun. And The Godfather 3 is one of them. I had no fun watching it. It wasn't even that fun to rail on it while I was watching it, quite frankly. You know, we had a lot of fun watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind and being like, what the fuck happened there? Like, there were redeemable qualities in that, like, to tie it back into the beginning conversation. We loved to hate it because the movie wasn't like that terrible, but it was also pretty fucking terrible. And it's like, what are we supposed to do with Godfather Part 3? There's no high points to like, and there's no low points that are worthy of my hatred. It's all just bad.
Yeah, it's just a 2.5 hour checklist of, I don't know if checklist is the right word, but it's almost like a choose your own adventure where you're like, oh, with that decision you've made, you could have done this, this, and this.
It's like reading a choose your own adventure straight through without actually choosing. You're just reading every option.
And they're all the bad ones. Yes. And they're all terrible.
You die via helicopter turret. Okay. And you die via assassin, and you die via poison in your treacle tart or whatever he was eating. It's just, ugh.
That was a cannoli, by the way. The world's slowest acting cannoli. I don't know what that poison was, but because that was a weird scene. Because Talia Shire poisons one of the I guess associate family members who was in bed with the Lucchese in this Pope deal. She gives him a cannoli. He has her try it. She fakes eating it, which, you know, that was a brilliant bit of acting. Like, how do you fake eating a cannoli? But I'd buy it. But then she's watching him from across the opera house with the little binoculars, and it takes him forever to get as much in his system as it needs to kill him, and he finally just, like, it looks almost like he dies in his sleep, but
he's just enjoying the ecstasy that is a good cannoli.
I guess so. Maybe she killed him with kindness because it was so unexpected and it was on his birthday. But
the mob boss's biggest enemy is kindness.
Unless
it's their daughter's wedding.
That's true. I kind of want to see that guy's headstone, though, because I've always wanted to see, this is morbid, but I've always wanted to see a grave marker of someone who was born on and died on their birthday.
I was thinking it would say something like, holy cannoli.
I can't let that one pass. Now I'm thinking about passing a cannoli, and that's doubly, I did that to myself. I think that's kind of Godfather 3.
Your face and the way you just said that is the perfect summation of this entire episode. I think that's kind of it. Like,
Jesus, do I sound like that?
I've never felt more curmudgeonly and like cantankerous than when I'm talking about Godfather 3 now. Just puts you in like an I'm 70, get off my lawn type of mood. Like, I don't need this in my cinema.
Yeah. Oh, and well, it's weird too, because the Coda is coming out in select theaters next Friday. you know, depending on how this pandemic goes, one of those select theaters can be like, you know, the ones you see in your living room, because it's coming to VOD on, I think, the following Tuesday. So it's a weird, another one of those weird strategies, like, we'll put it in a theater for a weekend and see how many people come. The answer is none, because they can just stay home and watch it the next week.
There you go.
But that really is it for Godfather 3. Thank you for going on this journey with me. We've watched Godfathers 1, 2, and 3 all together for late screening. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's our first saga come to a close.
Yeah. Now,
I guess you could count 2001 and 2010.
Yeah, that's true, because we've watched as many adaptations as they've made of those. We haven't finished the book quadrilogy. Now, here's my challenge. For the 40th anniversary, I think, of Godfather 3, we should read The Godfather by Mario Puzo for a page to screen, and then go back and rewatch all the movies.
I'm actually in for that. I was just I was thinking about it today, because I'm planning my reading schedule next probably 6 months. And usually what happens is it dissolves within a month, and I just read whatever I want. But I did double check to make sure that I had The Godfather, because Aaron got it for me a while ago. And it survived the move. It is ready whenever we are. So I'm in.
Okay. So considering it's a long book and these movies are really long, we should probably start now if we're going to make it to 2040 or 2030. Jeez. Yeah, for the 40th anniversary. Wow. Okay. I'm going to leave it there, because I feel like I've got like a slow acting poison cannoli going through me, because I'm losing my mind. But thank you again, Cole Rush of The Quill to Live. We'll be back in December talking about our last page to screen of the year. I don't know if we've actually got a late screening lined up, but we'll figure something out. It's going to be a good one.
I'm excited.
Yes. All right, man. Take care. And thanks again.
Fare thee well.
Yay.